It's become less and less about killing that elk and more about just playing that game with him. I hear about how awesome another animal is. I mean, I know this maybe sounds a little mean, but I say, yeah, but do they bugle? I will say you can listen to some people call and it sounds very one-dimensional, and then you can listen to other people call and it sounds echoey and three-dimensional. We're all in this together. The end game is the same for all of us. Just because I can't shoot out to the range he can shoot doesn't give me the right to tell him he can't. Breaking that silence with the call, it's a completely different thing than doing it in your house, I have to say. Hey guys, this is Steve Chappell from Elk Camp TV, and you're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Put down your latte and pull on your boots.
There's a lot of people that can pull the trigger on an animal, but they don't know what to do with it after.
If you would have told me that a stupid turkey was going to make me get that excited, I'd have told you you were crazy.
It's just a skill that you have to perfect over a lot of years.
Hunting is a tribal activity. We've lost the tribe. We can't even hunt together anymore.
Well, the people that are anti-hunting are usually pro-abortion. So kill the people, save the animals.
I just remember riding my horse back to camp with the northern lights and the moose behind me, and I'm like, this is why I've done this. This is as cool as an experience as I will get.
Hi, this is Jim Shockey.
This is Sam Sohol, the public land bus guy.
Hi, I'm Kimmy Greentree.
Hi, this is South Cox with the Western Bowhunter Podcast.
Hey, this is Ben DeDamonte, a.k.a. Shed Crazy.
You're listening to The Wild Initiative.
Hey, all, welcome to another episode of The Wild Initiative, brought to you as part of the Waypoint Outdoor Collective. All right, y'all, so getting on to today's episode, super excited to have the one and only Steve Chappell on with me. Steve is the host of Elk Camp TV, runs Chappell's Guide Service down in Arizona. Y'all, if you want to talk elk, this is the guy. Hey, Steve, thanks so much. I'm super glad to have you on.
Sam, it's so good to be here today. I appreciate you having me on. I'm looking forward to visiting with you here.
Absolutely. And so, you know, the thing I always love to start out with is, you know, because everyone's got a different story. There's hundreds and hundreds of infinite different ways that people have gotten into hunting. And how did you get introduced to all this? How'd you get into hunting and elk and all of this originally?
Yeah, so I literally was the kid who grew up in the country and lived at the end of a dirt road. And it was in rural Colorado. My dad is a farmer and was back then and was a hunter. My granddad was a hunter. So really, I was really fortunate just to know no different. You know, I guess you could say you were raised a hunter when you got a, you know, a BB gun when you were 8 years old. You got pellets for it when you were nine. When you were, I think, 12, I got a 22, 13, a shotgun, 14, a 270. So yeah, just guns all the way along. I can still remember distinctly back in my BB gun days when I was really young, setting an alarm and getting up, you know, right before first light and going out and literally hunting all day and just taking a break and coming back in for lunch and telling my mom all my gory hunting stories and then going back out and hitting it all afternoon and coming back with more stories in the evening. So my mom, bless her heart, had to hear a lot of gory stories from me. So yeah, I mean, that's really how it all happened. It originated from the very beginning. So I really just came by it, I guess, naturally through the family. So I'm very thankful for that.
You know, it's funny. I always, I think I've probably talked about this a few times on the podcast, but, you know, I think that's one of those things that that really shows how inherent hunting is in our nature, in that, like, yeah, you grew up in the country with the BB gun. I mean, I grew up in the middle of the suburbs in, you know, but I had a BB gun in the backyard of in Orange County. And I tell you what, anytime my mom was in the kitchen, you know, my mom would be in the kitchen cooking and we had the, like the window there that would look out into the backyard so she could keep an eye on me whenever I had my BB gun out there. And, you know, I was supposed to be shooting at whatever targets I had set up against the wall. Yeah. But man, I tell you what, the second she wasn't looking, those those pigeons that were sitting on the peak of the neighbor's roof, those started disappearing real quick. And then I'd hear my name get yelled from the house when I pushed my luck a little bit too much. But you know, I think it's one of those things, regardless of where you grew up, almost like it shows it, it's I feel like hunting is kind of an inherent thing. Like it's a desire, and it's built into all of us.
Yeah. I think for most of us, it is a natural thing and something that kind of has to be suppressed actually, if you don't do it. Yeah, I know for me growing up, I couldn't have seen it any other way. It was just a natural outlet for me. I love the outdoors, love being out there. You know, I'll admit when I was younger, it was kind of fun to kill birds and rabbits. And, you know, but the older I get, the less the kill is important to me. It's more about being out there, enjoying nature, enjoying the experiences. For me, it's about calling elk in, you know, being a part of that calling game and winning that with them. So yeah, it was just a kind of a natural progression for me, but I wouldn't want it any other way. And I don't think as hunters that we need to apologize or give long explanations for why we do it. Like you say, Sam, it's just it's a natural thing to us.
So what, you know, what took this kid that loved, you know, going out with his rifle and shooting rabbits and squirrels or whatever it was, what then, how that develop into this passion now you have for elk and calling elk?
Yeah, so I would say that, you know, when I was got into my early 20s, I started, you know, watching and following videos from guys like Will Primos, Wayne Carlton, Larry Jones, and it just really fueled a passion in me. I just really, you know, really thought I would enjoy calling elk because of the fact that it's a game, you know, it's like a chess match. And I can still remember going and getting my very first elk read, and it was a Larry D. Jones mouth read. And I'm telling you, Sam, it probably took me 2 or 3 weeks, like we were visiting about a little earlier. It did not come naturally to me at all. I had no idea when I put it in my mouth how to get a sound out of it or anything like that. But finally I did. And then again, just continually watching those people that I kind of mentored, like Primos and Carlton, watching their videos, I learned a ton, because I feel like I watched those videos as a student and not just an observer. So, you know, I would see how they set up, you know, okay, the bull bugled, what sound did they make back to it? How much time did they give the bull before they made another call? So I would say just, you know, seeing that success that they were having really fueled a passion in me. I got my first video camera, I would say in 93 or 94. And then that quickly became something that I really gravitated to, because I quickly really liked the video aspect of it and being able to not just live it out in the field, but then able to bring it back and actually watch it and see it go down right there in front of me over and over. It was just amazing. And I was quickly hooked on video. And so then that progressed into, you know, into the Extreme Bulls video series a few years later, and then ultimately into this TV show. It's been about a 25-year journey, to be honest with you. I never thought I would get here. But you know, God guided and directed, and I'm glad to be here where I'm at, and just feel really blessed and fortunate to be doing what I love, for sure.
So tell me a little bit about Elk Camp TV, your show.
Yeah, so we just finished up the third season. So it started airing in 2018. And it, as the name implies, it's all elk. I think I've mixed in maybe one or two mule deer hunts during the three seasons. So I've really stayed elk focused with it. It airs on Sportsman Channel, and it is the only elk specific show on the network, which I think gives it a real niche there. And a lot of viewers like that fact about it, that it's just elk specific. So yeah, it airs basically early July through December. So it airs quarters 3 and 4. So season 4 will start airing this summer again in early July and run through December. I just got through the Arizona application period deadline. So now I'm sitting down to start editing for season 4, feeling a little bit of a panic because I feel a little bit behind. But this being season 4 and me editing the past 2 seasons, I feel like I've got a little bit of a grasp on it and a little bit of a formula for how I do things. So I'm really looking forward to, you know, pounding these episodes out. I would say it's really a hunting and encounter driven show. It's got the creative elements, you know, it's got time lapses and drone shots and, you know, all of the creative things in there, but it really sticks to the main thing, and that's elk hunting and more so elk calling. And so, also, if any of your listeners don't have network TV and watch their content digitally, seasons 1, 2, and 3 are on My Outdoor TV. It's an app that they can log on to. There's a free trial they can try out. I think it's just like $9 a month or $99 a year. So they could watch all 3 seasons. There's also all the shows that air on Sportsman Channel and Outdoor Channel are on that MOTV, My Outdoor TV app. So I think for guys that get their content digitally, that would be a great thing for them to check out and try out.
I actually subscribed to that for quite a while, and then it kind of came to the day where I realized I don't need another television subscription app. But I subscribed to that for quite a while, and I would just constantly have it running. It's got everything. Uh-huh. Like, it's just so much content.
Hundreds of shows.
And one of the things I actually honestly really loved about it is it has a lot of old stuff too. Mm-hmm. And for someone like me that, you know, a lot of the times, you know, you come into these conversations, and I'm at the point now where I know who most of these guys are and the names and what they've done. But you kind of come into these conversations and people start talking about, oh, you know, Wayne Carlton this and Will Primos that. And you're kind of like, okay, like, I don't know who you're talking about, but that's cool. You know, you do a little bit of research, and you know, the next time you kind of know what's going on, but it's cool to be able to get a little bit more of that kind of classic hunting television that you may have missed out on if you didn't grow up watching it.
Right.
And so I really enjoyed that aspect. And I found, you know, I went and watched some really old Jim Shockey episodes and some stuff on there. And that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. Yeah. Jim was one of the originals for sure. He still puts out great content. He's got a new show called Shock Therapy that I've really been enjoying, where he brings on some people from the outdoor industry and interviews them. And it's just very interesting. And it's not just an interview. It's full of footage. So when they're talking about something, they're actually reliving something and showing the footage. So, yeah, very good show. Yeah, there's lots of great shows out there, lots of great content on TV and digitally. You know, young people have a lot to choose from these days, lots of people to learn from for sure.
Yeah, it's a far cry from the days when you used to have to send in a check with an envelope, you know, and wait to get a VHS tape back, you know, a couple of weeks later. And yeah, I'm sure we would watch that one VHS tape until it was just worn through.
Yeah. My first couple of Extreme Bulls videos were on VHS. So that kind of dates me. Luckily, it quickly went to DVD. But then, as we know, after about, I don't know, maybe a decade or so of DVDs, and it being a very popular thing, I can remember doing a very good DVD sales business with Sportsman's Warehouse and Cabela's and lots of sporting goods stores. And it just died really with YouTube coming along. So DVDs became less and less popular. So I kind of had to, after I made Extreme Bulls 8, I really got to the point where I had to decide, am I going to continue to do this and step off the cliff, so to speak, and try to take the next step and go into TV, or am I just going to let this stop? And, you know, for me, you know, my passion was so deep with video and that aspect of it that I took that risk, and I'm really glad I did. It was not an easy road for sure. I think, you know, big misnomer out there is that if you have a good show or a good idea for a good show, that sponsors are going to hop on board, that, you know, Sportsman Channel or another network's going to approach you and pay you to air your show. And it's just the opposite. You're paying for the airtime, and the sponsors are not lining up to support you. It's a grind. I mean, you really have to have the show in place. You have to know, tell them what your airtimes are, what your viewership is, to even get a an ear, you know, to listen to you at all. So it's not an easy thing to do. And it definitely was a hard road, and I grinded through it. And luckily we're going into season four. It's hard to believe that looking back now.
Yeah, I'm coming up on this March will be the fourth year I've been running the podcast. And it's like every time the beginning of March rolls around, I'm like, man, like I'm still doing this and people are still listening, huh? Wow, that's kind of amazing.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah. It just time flies by when you're doing something like this. It really does.
And, you know, I always, you know, you kind of talk about grinding through some of that stuff, and it's, you know, it's a lot of work. Like, it's not an easy thing. And if it wasn't something we love doing, it probably would not happen in the slightest. Cause I think, I never want to say there's more work than reward, because the reward is in actually doing it. But like when it comes down the line, I feel like, okay, yeah, you do all this work, but you don't necessarily do it for the, what, you know, quote unquote financial reward, you know,
right?
Because like you said, you don't have Sportsman's Channel kicking down your door to write you a check.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. You find out real quick, don't you, Sam, when you're doing your own thing, whether you're really passionate about it or not, because you have to be self-motivated. And there's days, I'm telling you, when it's time, when I know I've got a deadline coming up for an episode and I need to sit down and edit, you find out real fast how motivated you are. And I have to say, some days I'm more motivated than other days. And some days I'm a little bit of a procrastinator, and causes me at times to have to stay up till three or four in the morning to catch up. I'm sure you know how that is.
Oh, yeah.
But it's all a labor of love. Ultimately, I have to say it beats a 9-to-5 job any day for sure.
Oh yeah. I mean, if it was just like, if running the podcast was just this part, just having the conversations, and then, you know, could wave a magic wand and everything would be done, that would be one thing, you know. Or if for you, if it was just going out and hunting and filming that,
yeah,
that would be magic. That's like the easy, that's the fun part. That's like the cool part. Then there's like that's only about 10% of it though. And then all the hard work happens after that.
Exactly. But yeah, the editing part, when you come back and you got, you know, footage from camera A, footage from camera B, drone footage, time lapses, interviews. And I always have this feeling, Sam, of kind of desperation at the beginning of an episode, thinking, how am I going to get this from the starting point to the finish line? Even though I've done it, you know, 30 times now, or however many times I've done it, you just have this feeling of kind of hopelessness when you start one out. It's almost like, I feel like it's kind of that writer's block when you were in college and you had a term paper and you just could not get that first sentence out. But ultimately at some point you just do, and then it flows from there, and it all comes together at some point. So.
No, I definitely feel that. You know, you've been running Elk Camp TV, and your focus is very much more on the nitty gritty of the actual hunt and the calling in of the animal. It's not, you know, and every show is different. You know, every hunting show, every little short film, every clip you watch, everyone's got, you can tell what each person's passionate about. And for you, I can definitely tell from all the episodes I've watched, and it's very much about the calling for you. Am I correct in saying that?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, sometimes people ask me, gosh, why don't you get aggravated when someone misses an elk that you called in? You know, you called these giant bulls in for this guy and he missed them. And for me, like I was telling you earlier, it's become less and less about killing that elk and more about just playing that game with him. And for me, when I'm able to call that elk in and, you know, beat him on his own turf and have him come in totally duped to the call and think that I'm something I'm not, that's just such a feeling of satisfaction to me. You know, if my hunter gets that elk, that's fantastic. And if not, I look at it as great. We get to go call another one.
I was going to say, it's like, What do you mean? How do I get mad? That means I get to call in more elk. We don't have to pack it out now.
We get to get more footage. Yeah. I've honestly thought sometimes when I walk up to an elk, if they're in a bad place, I immediately start thinking about how far is the nearest road? How far away is the truck? And I just want to walk up to that elk and say, thanks for your thrill. Let us take a few photos and you can just get up and move along. You know? Like fishing, you know, kill and release.
Oh my gosh. Who did I just did a podcast with someone and the whole time we were talking about, it was with a bass fisherman actually. Yeah. And so we were having a discussion about, shoot and release hunting.
That would be a thing right there.
Yeah. So if somehow you could do like a, you know, those, have you seen those videos for like archery tag where, you know, if you could do that or, but you know, foam tipped arrow, elk has to lay down, you go take your picture and then, you know, there you go, move along.
There's a lot to be said for that. There's times when I could go for that. Absolutely. Especially the older I get and the heavier those quarters get.
I'm not even that old and they're pretty dang heavy.
They are. Yes, they are. Yeah. My days of packing two quarters are done. I think a hind is plenty for me.
Oh yeah. I tell you, you know, this, we were talking about my Arizona hunt with John Stallone. And, I tell you what, there was a couple of times cause we, you know, we were chasing those bugles and it's like, and that's the thing we were talking about that earlier, this last year in Arizona, they just wouldn't bugle. So if you heard a bugle anywhere that you were sure was an elk, you were going after that because you guaranteed not going to hear anything else. And so I tell you, there's a couple of days we were hiking all over Kingdom Come. And, you know, the nice thing about Arizona is it's pretty dang accessible. Like you have to put in some work to really get miles away from the nearest road, but you can do it. And there was some rough days, and I'll tell you what, we were lucky in that that final day we had found a road and we were going in on some elk we had located the day before, and we picked them up and it was a pretty decent, like pretty decently nice pack out. You know, we that was not too miserable of a pack out. I'll take that for sure. But
that's good.
Yeah, there's some of those days when we were in pretty deep and all I could start thinking was like, oh man. Yeah. After the first trip back, we're finding a way to get the car a lot closer.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the beautiful thing about these mapping apps, you know, like Onyx and in Arizona, that Flatline mapping app is amazing because you can, you know, pulls up your location and you can immediately start looking for roads around you. And if you can just get that elk pack to a road that you can get a vehicle or a quad to, then you're pretty golden.
Oh yeah.
So we have a lot of technology these days that we used to not have. I can remember before GPSs, you know, I remember one time hunting in Southern Colorado and I think I was probably about 16 years old and it came in and started snowing so hard. And I was probably a mile and a half to 2 miles from camp. It was snowing so hard. It was literally snowing my tracks in. And the visibility became probably less than 100 yards. And I remember getting turned around and walking out to the edge of this canyon. And luckily, when I got to the edge of the canyon, I knew where I was at and I was going the wrong direction. So I turned around and went back and found camp. And I bet it snowed 18 inches that night. So that would have been a good time to have a mapping app for sure. I'm lucky I'm not still out there in the snowstorm right now.
We'd have some other hunter finally come along and find you frozen like a caveman in a giant, giant block of ice.
Exactly.
So, you know, your passion then is calling. And I really honestly think, you know, there's a lot of amazing things about elk, but I feel like how elk talk, that's what really takes them from like a really cool creature that people love to hunt. Like, I feel like mule deer, people are passionate about hunting mule deer. There's a lot of crazy mule deer people out there, but even them, I don't think anybody would use the term like magical or something to describe hunting mule deer. They're like, that was awesome. That was badass. That was like, oh my gosh, these are the coolest animals ever. Those are the crazy mule deer people. But like, there's just something magical about hunting elk. And I think, I mean, you may have a different opinion, but I think it's how they communicate, how they talk. It takes them from like a cool creature to this amazing, like fantasy creature that is almost mythological.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Anytime I hear about how awesome another animal is, I mean, I know this is, you know, maybe sounds a little mean, but I say, yeah, but do they bugle? You know, I agree with you. I think that's what separates an elk from any other animal is that vocal aspect. And it's not just the fact that they're vocal, because there's other animals, lots of animals are vocal, but it's just the three-dimensional quality, the beauty of those sounds, you know, the bugles, the chuckles, glunking, all the sounds that the bulls make. And then the sounds that the cows make. I mean, you wouldn't hardly believe that that sound that comes out of a cow is real unless you were sitting there looking at them. It sounds kind of bird-like, cat-like, whale-like maybe. It's just so unique. And then being able to interact with them with calls and, you know, have up close and personal encounters with them because of that vocal nature just separates them another notch, in my opinion. You know, I'm a self-admitted one trick pony. I just love elk hunting. That's where it starts and ends for me. I love the calling game of it. You know, I haven't even mentioned, but I've been really fortunate and blessed to be working with Rocky Mountain Hunting Calls going into my 11th year now, working on a signature series line of calls with them. Yeah, all the way, like I said, from getting that first diaphragm elk call back in the early 90s to where it's come now full circle. I just can't hardly believe it looking back that it's gotten to this point. But yeah, I just absolutely love it. And I always say it's a good thing there's only one rut per year, only one September, or I would not be a married guy. I can guarantee you that, Sam.
Well, and it's like, it's hard enough thinking about it all year and wanting to prepare for season. And it's, you know, everybody talks about, okay, you know, hunting season's coming up. I'm like, I almost get nervous when hunting season's coming up because it's like, it's all I've been thinking about all year long. And it's all I've been preparing for and this and that. I'm like, you know, it's the oldest, you know, most people use it in terms of fitness, but it's like the whole concept of there's no off season. I'm elk hunting year round. You know, it's,
yeah,
I'm either, you know, e-scouting or planning, you know, searching, looking at maps or searching units or researching, or I'm practicing, you know, practicing with my bow. I'm sitting around in my car when I'm driving into town. I find so many dang diaphragm calls in weird spots in my car. Like I'll drop something between the seats and I reach down and I'm like, what? Oh, that's where that one went.
Like, pour a little water on it and see if it works.
Like, this one's looking a little sticky. I may not want to, may not want to use that one.
Yeah. But that's where you become a good caller, you know, is in the off season. I think the biggest mistake is to try learning elk calling on the elk during the season, you know, go to the sporting goods store and buy your call and head to the woods and immediately testing it out on the elk. I think where someone becomes better and better at calling. And I've always said that calling is a journey and it's not a destination. And I like to think that, you know, I've never totally mastered it because I feel like I get schooled every year by the elk, because every single encounter that you have with a bull is unique. So I feel like you need to learn from that. And the more sounds that you have in your repertoire, the more effective you can be, because you've got something there that maybe just every other person doesn't have to throw at that bull. So it's just a progression and something that I feel like the off season is the time to get better at and more comfortable with it. You know, driving around in the vehicle for me, when I used to drive a lot of tractor, I would practice a lot there. I can remember one time coming home from a outdoor trade show in Las Vegas. And I was determined, this was back in the late 90s, that I was going to learn to chuckle on the way home. Probably not the safest thing to do as I was driving, But I had a grunt tube, and by golly, I sat there and I practiced and I practiced, and I actually had a pretty big breakthrough on that trip learning to chuckle. But yeah, that's when you get better, is in the off season, and confidence is everything when you go out there to call, knowing how it's going to come out when you blow it, when there's an elk listening to it, because there's nothing more intimidating than going out there in the woods and breaking that silence with a call. It's a completely different thing than doing it in your house, I have to say.
There have been some long trips, whether it's, you know, just heading out for the season or whatever it may happen to be, some very long drives where I swear I have called my mouth raw. Like, I've just, whatever, 10 hours straight of elk calling, to where my mouth is dry. My poor reed is probably blown out at this point from nonstop bugles and blowing my eardrums out sitting in the car. It's not nearly as fun as doing it in traffic when you have people with their windows down, like stop next to you.
Totally.
And you can blast a bugle and scare the crap out of them.
Yeah.
But, you do get some odd looks on the highway sometimes, depending on which state you're in.
Right.
You get some really interesting looks from people driving by you. Like, is he drinking something out of that?
Yeah, exactly. I've got one right here. They're wondering what that is. He's drinking something out of that. This is, by the way, the Rogue bugle tube. And this year in 2021, we're releasing it in Scree camo. I don't know if you've heard of Scree, but a very, very nice pattern. I'm really excited about, you know, obviously the sound quality of this bugle is amazing. It's so three-dimensional. But now I think it looks extra cool with this Scree Summit pattern. So really excited to hit the woods again with it this fall. And also, go hit the road and see, get some funny looks from people, right?
Exactly. So talking about elk calling, a lot of people, whether they're, you know, going into the elk woods for the first time, or maybe they're hunting a new area this year, say somebody's going into the woods, they've kind of maybe e-scouted or checked out an area, and they're like, you know what, I think there's going to be elk in here. Never hunted it before, but they're going into a new area. If you're hunting a new area like that, what is your strategy initially going in, going in during the season when you're actually going in on your hunt?
Yeah. So, you know, for me in Arizona, with it being mostly a semi-arid state for the most part, other than maybe units 1 and 27, the biggest key for me is finding water sources. I mean, if you're in elk country and you find water, you're going to find elk for sure, you know. And then I'm looking for good bedding areas that are adjacent to that water source. You know, in Arizona anyway, elk are not afraid to get 2, 3, 4 miles away from that water source. They really, especially during the rut, it seems like during the rut, they'll get further away from the water than you can even imagine. But again, that's the first key for me, is finding water. And then secondarily, I'm going to look for rubs, because I'm going to be looking for, you know, where the bulls are at, where they're rubbing that velvet off, but then more importantly, where they're rutting. So, you know, to me, a valuable find is not only just a fresh rub, but as I'm driving around, you know, scouting in the summer or prior to a hunt, even those older rubs that maybe happened in years past are very valuable to me, because that tells me that's a place that the elk have rutted in the past. And it seems like in Arizona anyway, and I'm sure elsewhere, bulls come back. They summer in certain areas. They shed their velvet, and then they go to rut in certain areas. They join up with those cow-calf groups. So that's something I'm looking for. So, you know, elk need water, they need feed, and they need seclusion, because unlike deer and other animals, they do not like human pressure. They don't like being close to people and pressure and unnatural sounds. They're very sensitive to that. So, you know, those are the main things I'm looking for.
So I've never been able to get a straight answer on this, and I'd love to get your opinion on, on this. When it comes to rubs, I've gotten so much conflicting information on, okay, yeah, you always want to be keeping an eye out for rubs, looking for rubs. And then I know it's going to differ depending on what part of the season you're in, but then I've had a lot of other people saying like, okay, yeah, you're seeing a ton of rubs. That was awesome right before the rut, but now they're not going to be anywhere near that. So you need to move. If you're seeing a ton of rubs, you need to be moving to a different location. What are your thoughts on that as far as like using rubs to tell whether there or not there are elk in the area? Like, does that really depend on what part of the season it is? And like, what are your thoughts on that?
I'd say there's truth to that on both sides, because I see what you're saying and what those people are saying. They're saying that if a bull rubbed off, say, August 8th or August 10th, and he was kind of alone when he did that, which is typical that time of year, they get a little bit less about being together with other bulls at that point because they start getting a little more cranky toward each other. So then they rub off and then they're going to go join up with cow calf groups. So there is a lot to be said about that. I would say as a follow up to finding the water sources, you know, if you're finding rubs and the nearby water sources, you're finding wallows and you're finding sign of bull being there, you know, again, namely wallows and big tracks around the water sources. Or if you're able to set up a trail camera, you know, you could verify with that and confirm with that. But you're correct. Rubs could work either way as far as in your scouting, that the bulls could be gone from that area. So I would look to confirm or deny that at the water sources nearby.
So it's kind of like, okay, rubs are good enough to tell you bulls have been here at one point, and it gives you direction as far as, okay, now I should look at some of these other, if I'm seeing rubs, I should look a little more closely at these water sources to see if I can pick up more sign over here. It's effectively just one sign that you shouldn't really rely on too much without confirming and indications from other sources.
I totally agree with that. Absolutely. Totally confirming that at the water sources. And I know a lot of your listeners probably hunt mountain country that's not semi-arid like Arizona. And in the mountain country, they're going to be looking for seeps and springs and wallows, you know, up on benches and things like that, that are going to be, you know, on the northeast slopes. So they're going to want to be looking for bull sign and wallows there to confirm that there's bulls around there. And then obviously the best thing is, you know, once you get into late August, hopefully they start bugling a little bit and you can really confirm that they're there. Yeah.
So then, yeah, as we're getting into the rut and, you know, late August and into September, the rut's kicking off and, you know, you're in an area, you know, there's going to be bulls. Maybe an initial calling strategy going into an area like that?
Yeah, you know, Sam, I've always been guilty for the most part of being a lover rather than a fighter. So by and large, my success over the years, you know, just generically, I'll say, has been with cow calling. And I've called bulls in that have come enthusiastically into cow calls. I can still remember, you know, the very first bull that I killed with a bow, went in the dark, crossed the river that was about thigh high. I would never do that again. thinking back on that, I think, man, I was crazy. Cross that river, hike up a steep hillside. I get up maybe about a half a mile above the river where I can hear now because the river's not drowning out all the sounds. You know, I had my trusty diaphragm mouth read and blew a couple of cow calls, and lo and behold, a bull erupts up on the hillside up above me. And I honestly couldn't hardly believe it. I kind of did a double take. I thought, did he really answer that? Yeah, he did. So I walked forward just like I'd seen on the videos I'd been watching. Bull was probably 200 to 300 yards away. So I walked up about another 100 yards, cut the distance down as I'd seen it done, you know, found a good spot by an aspen tree, set up, blew a couple of calls behind me, you know, to kind of deflect the sound and make it sound like it was further away. And the bull bugled back and I could tell he was closer and he was coming hard. A couple more cow calls and he was right up in my face at 30 yards. And I shot him. I double lunged him perfectly, but he just stood there as if nothing happened. And I thought, wow, if he's just going to stand there, I'm going to knock another arrow. So I slowly knock another arrow and shoot him again. And he goes up the hill about 75 yards and falls down right in front of me. And I can still remember thinking, wow, that was easy. I should have taken up archery elk hunting a long time ago. Now, of course, that was just, you know, a real great first experience with calling and bow hunting. And it's, you know, typically not that easy at all, but I can still remember just thinking that was not that hard, you know, get the wind right, blow some nice, sweet cow calls, deflect the sound a little bit behind me. And it just worked like a charm, as it has a lot. I do feel like, though, you know, the more I've hunted, there are bulls that I found more and more when I call, it's about the elk and not about me so much. I need to find out what they want to hear and give that sound to them. So I don't go to the field with a one mindset approach and I'm going to take my game to them and they better like it or not. I try to adapt. I try to adapt my calling and my strategy depending on how they're reacting to it. So if I'm not getting a reaction out of cow calling, yeah, I'll mix in some bugling. Might mix in some chuckling, some raking, you know, that time of year, like late August, early September, during that pre-rut time, you know, raking can be very effective because the bulls are, you know, really territorial that time of year and defensive of their area. So, you know, I tell people, again, don't go to the woods with one mindset, but try to be, you know, adaptable to what's presented to you and you'll be a lot more successful.
So, you know, somebody is like, okay, you know, I can do a cow call, I can do a bugle. What should they start building on, do you think? Like, what's a good kind of progression for them to start building when it comes to expanding their kind of call repertoire?
Yeah, I would say the first thing to improve in calling is to really try to master those sounds and really make them sound elk-like. Now, I realize that every elk sounds a little bit different, but I do feel like you can really identify elk versus people out there. So I feel like the more elk-like you sound, the more elk you're going to call in and the more effective you're going to be, whether it's with bugling or cow calling, either way. So, you know, with cow calling, you just really want to be able to get that nasally, three-dimensional, just sweet, sexy tone when you're cow calling. I will say you can listen to some people call and it sounds very one-dimensional, and then you can listen to other people call and it sounds echoey and three-dimensional. And I feel like someone who has that more three-dimensional sound is gonna have more success out there. A lot of that, Sam, is just due to the call, that the actual call that you're using. Some calls by design sound more one-dimensional. Like I can pick up certain calls and I'll say, I just sound thin and one-dimensional on that call versus sounding nasally and three-dimensional. You know, for me, the first call that I had the most success with, aside from the, you know, the mouth diaphragm encounter that I just told you about, is when I started picking up some of the open reed calls, you know, like originally the Primo's Hyperlip single, Wayne Carlton's Fighting Cow Call. And now I've got some calls, one called the Trophy Wife and another one called the Heartbreaker. They just have a real nasally, three-dimensional, almost barrel-like sound. And they really sound elk-like if you practice on them. And I always say you want to be able to blow them softly as much as you want to be able to blow them loudly, because the closer a bull gets to you, the more you want to be able to tone it down and make it sound a little more distant and not so harsh and brash right in his face. So I would encourage your listeners to not only work on, you know, a mouth read, which as a bow hunter, you know, you definitely need that in your bag of tricks because you need your hands free. But I'm telling you, you can call in so many bulls with an open reed call. I always look for ones, whether it's my call or someone else's call. I like an open reed call that's got a little bit thicker reed versus a thin, skinny reed. And then I also like them when they have a little flatter soundboard angle. And in other words, if you turn the call sideways to you and you're looking at it and you're looking at the reed and the soundboard, that reed should be very close or almost touch that soundboard. There shouldn't be a lot of separation. those calls by design to me sound better than the ones with the narrow, skinny reeds and a big gap between the soundboard and the reed. Yeah, they don't stick as readily, but to me, they sound more like a predator type call. They sound more like a rodent type sound. Mm-hmm. So yeah, again, I would just encourage your listeners to listen to elk. You know, there's so many videos out there. I'm sure you could get onto YouTube and type in, you know, elk sounds. I would encourage people to not only listen to good callers, but to listen to elk themselves. And when you practice with that sound of a background going on and try to mimic that sound and that cadence. Because again, I think they're the best teachers of all to be able to pick up the right tones, the right length of the call, the right cadence, all of that just plays into it. And again, I feel like even with me after doing this for 25, 30 years that I can improve every single year if it's just some subtle little nuance. You know, the last, I would say 4 or 5 years, I feel like where my calling has improved is in the bull sounds, namely with the lip ball bugle, or some people call it bull, Joel Turner called it the bull calling cows bugle. I don't know if you've talked to him or had him on your show, but he calls it the bull calling cows bugle. And what it is, it's a bugle that starts with a pretty high note and then it breaks into that buzzy, vibrating lip ball sound. And what he says it is and what I believe it is it's the bull calling the cows to him, showing off, if you will. And I have found, Sam, over and over, in fact, in 2019, the first 3 mornings of the Arizona archery hunt, I got in tight with herd bulls and their cows with my archery hunter. I got inside of 100 yards to those 3 separate herd bulls and their cows. And, you know, when those cows were nearby and that bull was in the right position and I blew that bull calling cows or lip ball bugle, I'm not kidding. It was immediate reaction every time. Those bulls instantly bugled back and marched right over to me as if to say, oh, no, you don't. You don't come in here and flirt with my cows and punch me in the nose like that. I'm going to come over here and knock you out of here. And they marched right over. And yeah, my archery hunter got 3 shots on the first 3 mornings of the hunt. But yeah, just looking to improve every single year, you know, pick a sound that you're going to, you know, focus on and get better at. And I think that's how you become a better caller each and every year.
You know, and I think just to echo what you said is if you're trying to mimic sounds, mimic the original sound.
Right.
Like there is benefits to watching videos of people calling and listening to those sounds. And I think that comes in the form of like, the technical how to work the call and how to create those sounds. But then once you've somewhat got that technique down, as you're trying to then learn the kind of the intricacies of the actual sounds themselves,
yeah,
that's when you need to go back to the videos of the actual elk, you know, because it's like playing a game of telephone, you know, so-and-so formed his calls off of watching this guy's videos, and then somebody else was watching him and learned how to make these sounds from them. And it slowly kind of changes along the way. And when, you know, you just go straight to the source and your elk calling is going to be significantly better if you're mimicking the actual elk rather than trying to mimic somebody mimicking elk.
Yeah, exactly. I can almost listen to people and go, he's emulating this guy with his bugle and he's emulating that guy with his chuckle, or he's emulating me with a cow call. I agree. You can learn, like you said, basically initially how to use the call, how to get sound out of it, kind of the big picture, so to speak, of the call itself. But then to fine tune it, it comes down to really listening to elk and patterning after them. That's one reason I really enjoy my trail cameras. I know there's big debates on trail cameras in some of the Western states right now. I can honestly say, Sam, that I've never used trail camera intel to kill a bull. Never have I done that. I mainly use them to get a barometer of the overall antler growth for that year. And then also I run them on video mode all the time because I love to hear the sounds that they make. You know, bulls, when they're in velvet, I don't think people realize how mean and aggressive they are to each other. Even when they're in velvet, they're grinding their teeth and they're hissing at each other like geese is what it sounds like. But even more so, you know, during the rut, I like to listen to, for me, when a pot of gold for me is when I have a bunch of cows in front of the camera and they're calling and I'm getting to listen to those sounds they're making, almost sounds as if they're blowing the sounds out through their nose or whatnot. And just all the subtle little intricacies of the calls they make. You know, that to me is the best sort of practice that you can have is listening to those elk. And again, for me, you know, I'll save those clips off my trail cameras more readily when there's cows calling in front of it, because it's such a valuable tool for practice calling.
I really, you know, now that I'm in Montana, that's one thing I'm excited to do a little bit of this year is, you know, I'm picking up some Spy Point trail cameras and I'm going to get to go, like hang them up and so with somewhere reasonably, you know, it's a little bit different when you have to drive 20 hours to get to your hunting spot and this and that. But now, you know, within reasonably a few hours, depending on where I'm going to be hunting this year, I can go hang trail cameras and I can get an idea of that climate and when those elk are making noise, you know. And it's obviously it's going to change as hunting season comes around, but I'm just kind of excited to get a little more involved in the scouting, getting some trail cams up, learning the areas and really being able to hunt home, you know, yeah, the same areas and check that out. It's super exciting for me. So,
yeah, it's so disappointing that trail cameras have become just such a hot topic, you know, with people on both sides of the equation. And unfortunately it's hunters against hunters, if you know what I mean, Sam, and that's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I think the bottom line is as hunters, we kind of need to self-regulate ourselves just a little bit. I think there's a little bit of a line that if you cross it and abuse the privilege, then it makes people angry and jealous. You know, if you have 100 or 300 cameras out there, people are going to get jealous about it. And the natural reaction is that the knee-jerk reaction is all the cameras need to be outlawed and, you know, they're an unfair advantage in this and that. But, you know, elk are such a rangy animal. That's what I've learned about them over the years, hunting them, scouting them, using trail cameras. They are so rangy. They use such a large area during the rut that it's very hard to pin them down, especially when there's other people out there hunting them and bumping them and moving them around. And like I said, I don't use trail cameras to kill elk. I just use them to enjoy getting to see them and see them on video in their own natural state. So, it's kind of unfortunate that it's become such a hot topic and they're debating whether to ban them or not.
And, you know, what you said is so important is it. I feel like the hunting community is generally pretty good at regulating itself. At policing itself and figuring this out. And then, every so often there's some topics that come up that are pretty heated. And I feel like this is a very polarizing one. There's a lot of people that are on one side that are just like, no, we need to be able to use trail cams completely unrestricted however we want. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other end of the spectrum where people are like, they need to just be banned completely. And there's not, it's one of those issues where there's not as many people, at least the vocal people there's not a lot of vocal people in the middle that are like, come on, let's just find like a happy balance here and use that. And especially for people like yourself, that you're not necessarily putting it directly on a water hole because you want to find that one specific bull that you're trying to kill that season. And, you know, so there's going to be this small water hole that's got the one poor tree that's probably going to fall over soon because the weight of the 42 trail. I mean, we've all seen that picture. Like that's the one picture that's going around constantly.
Right.
And I'll be honest with you. I see something like that. I see all those cameras on there. I wouldn't want to put another damn camera on that tree because I don't like people and I don't want to deal with them.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'd rather shoot a smaller bull somewhere else than have to deal with all that pressure and all constantly running into other people and worrying about it. That's not why I hunt.
Yeah.
I don't like people enough to do that.
You're exactly right. In Arizona, you know, again, with it being semi-arid and most of the water sources being man-made, the good water sources are going to have a lot of cameras on them. So I'm like you, Sam. I kind of gravitate away from those areas because if there's a good bull there, I know there's going to be 20 people that know about him and are going to be in there. And chances are I'm not going to kill him because he's going to get bumped. He's going to get pushed out of there. So I'm going to look to hunt elsewhere and maybe hunt, you know, around water sources, hopefully that are so big that people can't hang trail cameras and can't get the intel there. So, yeah, you know, and as far as trail cameras go, I really feel like you can take it down any road, you know, long range guns, more efficient bows, range finders, on and on and on. I don't feel like it's my prerogative to dictate to someone what their effective range is or what they can use or not use. I feel like we're all hunters. We're all in this together. The end game is the same for all of us. And by golly, if a guy practices with his long range rifle and is proficient with it, just because I can't shoot out to the range he can shoot, doesn't give me the right to tell him he can't. So, you know, I just really hope again that we can, you know, kind of self-police ourselves, self-monitor ourselves, and ultimately not fight amongst ourselves because we've got people coming at us from all angles. It's especially pronounced right now in this day and age that we live in this cancel culture that we live in. So let's not cancel ourselves out as hunters amongst ourselves.
Oh, yeah. And it's difficult to sit down and be like, okay, here is the exact line where technology needs to be removed from hunting, and this is the line we can't cross. And it's such, there's too many variables in the type of technology, the location, the species, the hunt, the this, that. There's too many variables to ever be able to draw a hard line. Cause like, I mean, look at states like Idaho, for example, where you're archery hunting, you're not allowed to have any sort of, you know, electronic equipment whatsoever attached to your bow. Mm-hmm. Nothing. You can't have a damn lighted knock. Pardon the language. You can't have a dang lighted knock on your arrow. I kind of get something like maybe sight illumination, you know, okay, right. That increases right. Your ability. Like, I still roll my eyes at that one because I'm like, okay, but yeah, okay, it increases the length of time you can hunt, your ability to blah 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 blah. Okay, I understand that, but then something like, I'm gonna get a fine if I attach my GoPro to my bow. Like, if you know, I got like one of those little tight, you know, little screw on clip things.
Yep,
and I want to attach my GoPro. So it is perfectly fine for me to have like a chest rig or have it attached to my pack, but it's not okay for me to have that attached to my bow. How does that make any sense? And
it doesn't.
And that's the problem when you define hard lines like that. But then I also get it. Like there would be a never ending red tape to figure out if we went the other way and had to do custom rules for everything. So I think that's why it's so important before this stuff gets to the point where suddenly we're arguing about it needing to be regulated like we are with the trail cams.
Yeah.
It's important for people to step back as ethical hunters, examine their reasons for doing things and start self-policing. Yeah. Look at that tree. If there's 40 trail cameras on there, probably shouldn't put another one on there.
Just agreed. Absolutely. And, you know, let's face it, even with all the technology these days, hunting is still hard. When you look at the success rates, especially for archery or even late season rifle hunting with these new long range rifles and scopes, it's still hard. Taking and tagging, killing an elk is still hard to do. So You know, I'm definitely not one of these people that's against technology. You know, like you were saying, how does mounting a GoPro on your bow, that makes it harder, in my opinion, makes it harder. As far as the lighted knock, that just aids in the recovery of an animal, which I'm all about. I'm all about, you know, making a clean, ethical kill, recovering that animal. So then you're not faced with that decision of, oh, gosh, I didn't recover this animal. Do I keep hunting? What do I do? How long do I look for this animal? So to me, anything that aids in a clean, ethical kill, you know, within the realms of that weapon, I feel should be legal, like a lighted knock. Absolutely.
And I, you know, and again, it can be a slippery slope. And I think all we're saying is look at it from the perspective of an ethical hunter. Take a moment to consider what you're doing and how, one, it'll affect perception of what we do, public perception, because that's important. That's how things suddenly get banned without it going through Fish and Wildlife, with it getting legislated, is public perception.
Yeah.
And, you know, just don't be a dick. Like, I mean, come on.
Be a good guy.
Be a good human being. Be an ethical human being. You know, if the technology will assist in, if it's all about making your hunt easier, then maybe it's not the right sort of technology. If it's about making a more ethical kill, then yeah. Then I think it's probably going to be a good thing.
Right.
You know, you could go into that.
Yeah. And then limit yourself to your own abilities. You know, you could put the same bow or the same gun in two different hunters' hands and get a different result just based on their proficiency and practice. So again, you know your limitations, and, you know, integrity is all about doing the right thing when nobody else is looking. And if there's an elk across a canyon at 1,000 yards and you have not practiced and you're not proficient at that range, you know, to take a shot at that kind of range when you have not put in the time is not the right thing to do. But that's not saying that somebody else hasn't. So you just got to know your limitations. Just like with anything, just like with calling, you know your strengths, know your weaknesses, work on your weaknesses, because that's the hardest thing to do, isn't it, Sam, to work on the things that you're not so good at. I know back in the days when I played basketball, you know, to practice dribbling with the hand that you're the weakest at wasn't fun. You would rather practice and dribble with the hand you're strongest at and shoot with the hand you're strongest at. But same way with hunting and elk calling, you know, work on those weak spots because it'll make you a more well-rounded, more effective hunter in the end, for sure.
So if folks wanted to find you online, find Elk Camp TV, if folks wanted to find Chapel's Guide Service, where are they looking?
Yeah, so on Instagram, they would be looking at Elk Camp TV. Facebook users could find us at Chapel Guide Service. My website is chapelguideservice.com. They can also get there.
Two P's, two L's.
Yep, chapel with two P's and two L's.com.
Okay.
Or an easier way, if they don't want to take on spelling chapel correctly, would just be to type in elkcamptv.com. Would basically get you to the same website. And we have a pretty active Instagram and Facebook page. My daughter actually handles that for me. Does a great job with that, just because I'm trying to wear several hats, and I let her do that for me. I'm glad to have her doing that.
Awesome. So I'll make sure to link to those on the show notes page. That's going to be thewildinitiative.com/190. But so one thing I always kind of like to wrap up with is say you run into someone, you know, at the store or whatever, they find out you're an elk hunter, and they make, man, you know, I've always wanted to do that. That just sounds so cool. But I don't know anyone that does it. I've never done this before. I don't know. There's a lot to learn. It's really intimidating. I don't know if this is something I can do. What encouragement would you give someone like that?
Well, first off, I would probably tell them that not everyone is 100% successful, for sure, and not to be intimidated at the point of entry. You know, I would encourage him with the fact that elk hunting is, like we were talking about earlier, is just so unique because of the vocal nature of it. And just so much fun to get out there, especially in September, because the weather's beautiful. The fall woods are just absolutely glorious. And the first time they hear an elk bugle, it will be life-changing for them if it's like it was for me. I could almost guarantee to someone that when they hear that first bugle, they're going to be totally hooked on it. And, you know, I would tell them just do it within their limitations and their skill set to start with. You know, don't feel like you have to eat the whole elephant in one bite. You know, there's so many elements involved, like you were saying, the shooting aspect of it, the calling aspect of it, the physical fitness part of it, which we all know elk hunting is fairly physical. You know, just compartmentalize each one of those. But I tell you, just the whole process of it is just absolutely wonderful and life-changing, and it really gives your hunting life purpose. So yeah, I would encourage them to take that first step and start down that path. They'll never regret it.
Fantastic. Well, I really appreciate you sitting down with me, taking the time. I'm glad we were able to make this happen.
Yeah, Sam, thank you so much. I'm already looking forward to September, right? I can't wait. Every year, that first bugle we get to hear is very special. And even though it's mid-February, I'm already anticipating it right now. So thank you.
All right, y'all, that'll do it for this episode of The Wild Initiative. Make sure to check out the show notes page at thewildinitiative.com/190. Get links to everything we talked about in today's episode. Big thank you to Steve for taking the time to hop on and lay down this episode with me. Make sure you check out Elk Camp TV. And if y'all are planning on hunting in Arizona this year, check out Chapel's Guide Service. That'll do it for this week. Looking forward to next time. But until then, I hope this podcast inspired you to get involved, get outdoors, and plan your initiative for the wild.
Thank you for listening to The Wild Initiative. Please take a moment to leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher, and head on over to thewildinitiative.com to get show notes, check out the blog, gear discounts, other podcasts from The Wild Initiative family, and more.